Hello, readers. My name is Jason Jeffries, and this is Bookin', brought to you by Quail Ridge Books, Raleigh, North Carolina's trusted community bookstore. My guest today is Katya Apikina, the recipient of an Elizabeth George Grant, an Olin Fellowship, the Alina Wilson Prize, and the Third Year Fiction Fellowship from Washington University in St. Louis. Recently, she has been shortlisted for an LA Times Book Award for her debut novel, The Deeper the Water, the Uglier the Fish, published by the fine folks at $2 Radio out of Columbus, Ohio. Katya, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's an honor to have you here. So the first thing I want to ask you is about the afterword to your novel, in which you thank Catherine Davis for reading multiple drafts of your novel. Catherine, if you don't know her, listeners, is a writer's writer, really one of the best. Her novel, The Thin Place, is one of those novels that has a permanent place on my bookshelves. Katya, how do you know Catherine, and how did she end up reading multiple drafts of your novel?
She was my professor in grad school, where I did my MFA at WashU in St. Louis. She was like the most just generous and attentive teacher, and it's a very small program, so it was like very intimate. And I don't know that, yeah, she, I didn't start this book while I was in grad school, so I had shown her some parts of it once I started working on it after grad school. But yeah, she just was so influential and encouraging, like I think for basically everybody who went through that program. And she still teaches there.
Excellent. You're very lucky. Next, I want to ask you about your experience getting your book published at $2 Radio. How did you find your way to Eric and Eliza, and what has it been like working with them?
It's been amazing. It's been great. I love $2 Radio. I had a friend who had published a book with them. So I think that was probably how they first got on my radar. Anne Marie Kinney, Radio Iris was the name of her book. Mm-hmm. And I just sent into like the slush pile and they picked it out and liked it. And yeah, working with them has just been a dream.
Great. Yeah. Radio Iris is a great book. I read that one as well. Let's turn our attention to your novel, The Deeper the Water, the Uglier the Fish. This novel revolves around two sisters, Edith and May, and most of the novel is told from their point of view. The novel starts in 1997, and the sisters are in New York City. Katya, can you tell our listeners why they are there?
So they moved from Louisiana, where they were living with their mom, to live with their dad, who they didn't know growing up, because their mother is committed to a mental hospital. And their dad is a famous novelist, but they didn't have any sort of relationship with him growing up until they got there, and they're like 14 and 16, so they're teenagers.
Great. And 1997 is a very interesting year. In my mind, I sort of marked that era of my life via what was happening in the world of music and the arts. One of the best albums of all time, in my opinion, OK Computer by Radiohead, was released in June of 1997. Can you tell us why you chose to place the novel in this year?
Yeah, I think it was an important date for me, too. It was when I was just starting high school. So I do think I was like particularly like a cultural sponge then. And just like aware of stuff that was happening. I had visited New York when I was in high school, and I lived in New York after, you know, I went to college in New York in the 2000s, but it was very different by the time I was living there. And when I was visiting it in the 90s, it still felt like kind of like exciting and gritty. But also I think, you know, the book takes place in 1997 and then also in 2012, but then it also kind of goes back in time as well to the civil rights era of like the 60s in the South. And I think just to like, there are also just kind of practical considerations of when things had to happen, when the parents could have met to have it still kind of coincide with certain historical events. So I think I was just kind of doing some math as well.
Thank you, Katya. I want to talk about May and Edith's father, Dennis. Dennis, as you mentioned, is an author who carries a certain amount of weight in the literary community. But some characters, not all characters, I think I must note somewhat importantly, but some characters view Dennis as a vampire in the way that he uses his ex-wife, Marianne, May and Edith's mother, and then his daughter, May, as muses, and even his friend, Fred, amongst many others, I'm sure. In such a way that he makes them question whether their relationships with him are real or whether they are just fodder for his art. I want to return to the relationship with May later, but my question now is, as an author, as an artist, how can one tiptoe around these types of relationships? Is it even possible to create without drawing on experience, which by necessity must involve those people who are your closest family members and friends?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it's funny because I think as a writer, I often feel like a vampire, but not so much like in the way that Dennis is. Like, it's not so literal. I don't really write about any like actual people or autobiographical experiences. Like this book, nothing in this book really is similar to my own personal experience. But I do feel like you're a vampire no matter what, because you're drawing on your own kind of like your interior emotional landscape, you know, and you're always taking stuff from other people, like consciously or not, like stories or pieces of, you know, pieces of their experiences, and then kind of reshuffling them and sprinkling them in a way that like suits your narrative, but has nothing really to do with like the original source. And I think that as a person reading a book, if like parts of your autobiography are in someone else's story, but like reshuffled in that way, it's probably really disconcerting and weird. I don't actually have any, like nobody's come up to me and said anything about it. And I don't have anything like very specific that I'm thinking about ways that I've done that, but I'm just sure I have, because I think it's just what writers do to some extent. But it is interesting. It's like people, I think, assume that a lot of details are like things that I've like experienced or seen, and really like most stuff is just made up or combined in a way to make it pretty unrecognizable.
Yeah, thanks. I guess the alternative is just doing something through exhaustive research, but then you've got folks like Karl Ove Knausgård who get sued by all his family members, I imagine. It must be pretty exhausting. Thank you, Katya. Listeners, we're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsor, and I'll be right back with Katya Apikina. The Bookin Podcast is sponsored by Libro FM Audiobooks. Libro FM lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore, Quail Ridge Books. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers around the country. With Libro.fm, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know the name. But you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community. Listeners of Bookin can get a 3-month audiobook membership for the price of one. Go to Libro.fm, that's Libro.fm, and enter Bookin, Bookin, in the promo code space. With each listen, take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores. I'm back with Katya Apikina, author of The Deeper the Water, The Uglier the Fish, published by $2 Radio. Katya, the character Edith hates her father, that he hasn't been around, that he hasn't been a part of her life. But she seems to forget this anger when her father, Dennis, talks about his participation in the civil rights movement. Can you talk to us about this thread in your novel?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that, well, to kind of give a little bit of background on the novel, when I was in my early 20s, I was doing research for a nonfiction project that was about white Southerners who got involved in the civil rights movement in the 50s. And nothing came of that book, but I had all of this archival research, which ended up kind of serving as the, I don't know, like the stuff from which this book basically like emerged from. So even though it's not really part of like the front story of the book, it is sort of the, it's the backstory. And then also like the structure itself of the book is really inspired by that kind of research because it's told from multiple points of view. And when I was doing research, you know, I was reading a lot of different documents and oral histories and stuff. So this book is sort of structured in the same way. And like what was so interesting to me when I was doing research was like the way that people sort of emerged from these multiple different and sometimes contradictory accounts. And people all had such different, you know, like the same event would be interpreted and felt so differently by different people. So that was sort of what inspired kind of the book in a lot of ways. That was sort of the starting point for the book. And I think another thing that was really interesting to me when I was doing this research is like people are complicated and flawed. And, you know, I would be doing this research about these people who are doing these really like brave things. And at the same time, you know, they were human and they were doing other things that were maybe kind of ugly. So I think with Dennis, what was interesting to me was like there was this aspect of him that Edith was like connected to or was interested in. That sort of felt separate. Like she was able to kind of separate that part out of him out from the other parts of him that she was experiencing, which is like a dad who was absent from her life. And she blamed him for her mother's like mental state. So I don't know. Does that answer your question, sort of?
Yeah, it sure does. Thank you so much. And Dennis and Marianne's other daughter, May, loves her father, loves him very deeply, so much so that she begins to play the role of her mother in an attempt, I think, to inspire her father's creative process. And this becomes a very twisted relationship. May's mother, Marianne, married Dennis when she was a very, very young girl, 15 or 16, I believe. Can you talk to us first about Dennis's marriage to Marianne at such a young age, and then secondly about how this affects his relationship with his daughter, May?
Yeah, so he marries her when she's, I think, 17, but he has known her since she was a kid, and sort of, you know, had been corresponding with her, and he had been friends with her dad, and her dad really did not like this relationship. So that is sort of like Marianne is sort of his obsession, and he writes about her. All of his novels are about their relationship and about her, and she's his muse. And yeah, May really wants her dad's attention and love, and his attention is always either on his work or on her mother. So, and you know, those two things are connected. So I think she begins to sort of tap into her resemblance to her mother and stuff to get the attention that she wants from her dad. And yeah, that's a pretty dark and uncomfortable part of the book. And it was very difficult to write for me.
Mm-hmm. It was a very effective thread. Thank you so much for writing it. Let's talk about mental health. The girl's mother, Marianne, again, has been sequestered in a mental hospital since her suicide attempt, and not her first suicide attempt, I think. While she is there, Edith visits her and finds her in such a condition that she's barely willing to communicate, partly because she's trying to protect her daughter and partly because she is kept heavily medicated. Can you talk about the role of formal mental health in your novel?
I think a lot of it is sort of about these relationships between parents and children and the way the boundaries between like yourself and another person can get very blurry. And I think that is something that probably most people experience at one point or another, especially when they're teenagers, when they're kind of trying to separate from their parents and like become, you know, individuated, separate people from their parents. But then it's just taken to like a very, to an extreme in the book, where the sort of boundary between Marianne and her daughter May is very blurry. As for like the mental hospital itself, I mean, it's kind of this like gothic setting, but it's also, I think Marianne is a complicated person, and I feel like there's like, I probably have a sense of what her like diagnosis would be or something, but it seems a little reductive to kind of like, I think like she's not just her diagnosis, you know, like she is she's like a very sensitive person who is probably very fragile, and at least in how she sees it, like Dennis and the way he sort of used her kind of pushed her already kind of fragile state into an vulnerable state. You know, she doesn't have, she was very close with her dad and he passed away and she doesn't have a mother. And she just kind of gets broken by this experience.
Thank you, Katya. Finally, I want to ask you about a relatively short section of your novel. When Edith has fled New York to go visit her mother in the hospital, she stops in West Virginia. And I've recently spoken with a lot of authors about West Virginia, Scott McClanahan, Misha Marin, and William T. Volman. What was the impetus of your decision to include the passage and locale in your novel? And I'm specifically thinking about the topic of Massey and mountaintop removal.
Well, it was something that I had. So all of the locations are places that I've spent some time in, I guess, in the book. That's sort of the only thing that is very like autobiographical in the book is the places. And I have been to West Virginia and to specifically to the places I describe where there's where they're doing mountaintop removal. And I think I just was really affected by it when I went there. So that ended up being part of her road trip as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Katya, would you like to read us a passage from your novel?
Sure. So I'm going to read two short sections. The first one is from, and they're not close together in the book, but the first one is from Dennis Lomax's journal. That's the dad. And it's from 1970. Last night, I began something big, alive. I don't want to speak too soon, but maybe finally a book. I typed, and Marianne lay on the mattress on the floor watching me. With her, I am an open glove welcoming a hand. It is her energy working through me. I'm certain of it. I wrote all night. Outside, it rained. Marianne lay on her back, raised her arm, squinted at her ring, fell asleep. Yesterday, my sister came into the city for a visit, and as we were passing City Hall, I felt compelled to get married. We bought carnations dyed bright blue from a deli across the street. Look, Marianne had said, running her thumb along the stems, veined like arms. We stopped a tourist on the street, asked him to take a picture of us with his camera. He promised to mail it, and since our marriage, the urge to write has consumed me. Beneath all my words like subway clatter, my wife, my life, my wife. It was already light out when I stopped and crawled in beside her. I needed more of her to keep going. They bit me all night long, she told me, sleepily showing me her arm, a row of small red welts. The bedbugs live between the floorboards and inside the electrical sockets. I'll bite you too, I said, and I did. Then after, in the bathroom mirror as I washed my face, I caught sight of my earlobe, two uneven lines, marks from her crooked front teeth, and again that zap of desire. I ran back to bed, unbuttoned the blouse from the bottom that she had begun buttoning from the top. She's shy, but about all the wrong things. I moved her hands off her breasts and kissed her wrists, pinned her down, and then her whispered refrain, "You can save me," for which there is only one answer, "Yes, of course, yes." And this next section is from Marianne. McLean's journal from 1985, so 15 years after that. They make me fill out idiotic worksheets here. I wonder about my head, the feeling of cotton in my head. I think of Daddy, a cotton ball sticking out of his nose, out of his ear. Oh, how he was prone to infections. They say not to worry. The cotton feeling is because of the coma. To give it a few days and it will dissipate. I think, no, as usual, I have not made myself clear. I want more cotton. I want to be taxidermied, but they don't do that at this hospital. The therapist is an idiot. I told him about the tree stump, about how I took the girls to the woods near where my house used to be, Daddy's art studio flattened under a parking lot for a piggly fucking wiggly. There is no dignity. There is no justice. We were walking, even though I had not meant to get out of the car. We were walking, and then I was hitting a rotten tree stump with a stick. It would make this thump when I hit it, a dull sound. And I don't know why, but that sound excited me very much. I could feel it in my heart. The girls were like little monkeys. They found their own sticks, and they were digging in the ground with them. May had a wet cough. It gave me the feeling that her insides were the rotten stump, and it was her I had been hitting. It's terrible. It's terrible to always have to keep track of the edges of things as they slide away from you. Of course, the therapist didn't know what to make of the story. It's okay to express anger, he said. Hit something, that's an idea, holding out his palms for me to punch. The worst part is that Dennis is the only one left who has any idea what I'm talking about. How infuriating to have him as a screen always between me and the world, my translator, my Apollo. What's it like to be married to a man who understands women so keenly, people have asked me. It's unbearable. Unbearable. He is a thief. He steals from me constantly, though what exactly I can't say. And he's a liar, and what it is exactly he lies about, I can't say either, but you see, this doesn't make it any less true. And that I, at 16, could have foreseen it. I was the one, after all, who chose the name Cassandra. Apollo spits in her mouth, and now nobody believes me. Those thick alligator teardrops sliding down his cheeks as he suffocates me, for my own good, as he squeezes me from the bottom up. Literally? That's what Doreen wants to know. Literally, not literally. What's the difference? His breath is on my face even when he isn't here. So.
Thank you, Kaya. That was a fantastic reading, and this is a fantastic novel. I really have not read anything quite like it. I've been speaking with Kaya Apikina, author of The Deeper the Water, The Uglier the Fish, published by $2 Radio. Kaya, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Yep. Once again, I would like to thank Kaya Apikina for joining me. Her book, The Deeper the Water, The Uglier the Fish, can be purchased in-store at Quail Ridge Books or online at www.quailridgebooks.com. Our sponsor is Libro.fm Audiobooks. Please navigate over to Libro.fm and enter the promo code BOOKIN. That's BOOKIN in the promo code space to get 3 months of audiobooks for the price of one. My name is Jason Jefferies, and this has been BOOKIN.